music.
You are the creator of Musician Nutrition.
Yeah, it's my idea.
Apologies for that small technical hitch there. I pressed the wrong button.
Sport.
This new football generation is so overconsumed by stats.
Probably why you've seen a bit of a decline in true number nine goal scorers.
£1 billion bottle jobs.
Arts.
That's the Chris Nolan effect, though. Chris Nolan makes Oscar bait films that do well box office.
Sorry, guys, but if you give your partner a pair of shoes, they will run away from you.
Speech.
You would never see me on public transport ever again. Uber everywhere. I mean, please, I'm sure some of you guys do that already.
It's because I speak actual English, that's why. Sorry for that.
News.
The Parthenon is just like this really kind of integral part of Greece. Imagine if the Houses of Parliament were blown up by someone who invaded England.
And instead of looking into why does this child not feel safe in school, they went, you can't call your mum without asking us first.
Hello and welcome to The Big Decision 2024. I'm James Lewis, the head of news here at 4:12:51 AM. I'm one of your co-hosts for this evening.
Thank you to those still sticking with us. We are still covering the semi-finals here at Battle of the Bands. I'm here with Projectile Dysfunction, who just closed an amazing set.
Welcome back to Raw's coverage of Varsity 2024. We're back for the women's volleyball. But before that,
the bear's coming.
The bear's coming.
Do you think we can get?
Is the bear? Is the bear? That? Wait,
can we get away?
Pull him over.
This is Raw 12:51 AM.
Hello and welcome to this podcast edition of Insight, the show that gives Warwick students the opportunity to talk about the issues that matter, both here on campus and beyond. It is James Lewis here in the chair for, well, however long this podcast is going to take. We're doing a podcast edition of the show this week. But that doesn't mean that we haven't got some fun and interesting things to be discussing this week. In this podcast, we're going to be delving in and wrapping up our coverage of the SU elections that took place last week. We're also going to take a look at the budget that happened last week, the government bringing forward its budget and some of the poll ratings that the Conservatives were facing last week. And we're also going to wrap up, as we've had a focus on Women's Week here at Raw 12:51 AM, we're going to have a little bit of a discussion about whether Parliament is welcoming and inclusive to women and more politics in general on that one. But I think it's time to introduce my panel of guests, who are, of course, always here, ready to give their thoughts on the issues. They're going to introduce themselves one by one.
Hello, I'm Ben. I'm a first-year PACE student and excited to be back in a special podcast edition now as well. Can't wait.
Hi, I'm Glay. I'm a finalist. I'm kind of sad considering the current situation with our servers. However, all will be good, and this will be sadly the last Insight with James. I'm going to tear up.
Hi, yeah, I'm Matthew. I'm a first year, and just happy to be here on this special podcast edition.
Hello, I'm Angel. I'm also a finalist. I can't believe that I'm on this show on the first episode, and now I'm in the podcast edition as well.
There we go. We're really playing on the fact that this is a podcast today. I'm still going to put in all of the beds and stuff underneath to make it sound like we're on air and having a good time. But thank you very much, you all, for joining me today. Yeah, and what is going to be my final insight here as head of news at Raw 12:51 AM, but be in the capable hands of Amelia Coleman come next term. So that's all very, very exciting. Well, let's get on to our first topic of discussion this week. The SU spring elections were taking place on campus last week, the buzz of elections. And Raw, we're very delighted to once again host the results show on Friday night, where we announce your next SU full-time officer team, the part-time officers, and NUS delegates going to the conference in Blackpool. And just to run you through who was elected. So your next SU president is going to be Anina Hall. VP for Education is Maniba Amjad. VP for Democracy and Development is Sasha King-Smith. VP for Welfare and Campaigns is Naomi Carter. VP for Societies is Joe Stanley. And the VP for Sport is Louis Gosling. Now, those are going to be your next full-time officer team. We obviously had part-time officers elected and NUS delegates. And if you want to find out the full breakdown of results and who was elected, you can go to the SU website, warwicksu.com/elections. Now, of course, with these SU elections, there are plenty of different issues that are on students' minds when they come to vote. Now, Amelia Coleman, your incoming head of news here at Raw, was out in the field on campus talking to students to find out what was important to them in these SU elections.
Today, Raw News is asking campus
what the biggest issues are that are facing students ahead of the SU elections.
What do you think is the biggest issues faced by students on campus?
Well, a lot of students are involved in many wonderful societies here on campus. Sometimes they find it a little hard to do all that they want with the amount of red tape. Would you agree?
Yeah, I definitely agree. And on that, I'd say cost of living. And relating to societies and sports, federation fees, that's quite a big problem.
Yeah.
It puts me off signing up.
I think one of them would probably be the transport cost, especially for second and third years who come to uni every day.
I'd say cost of living.
What do you think is the biggest issue faced by Warwick students?
I think one of the biggest things we see, especially for first years coming onto campus, is the cost of accommodation. Places that, like Bluebell or Vic, some of the larger accommodations are really expensive, eating student loans, means a lot of students are facing more debt than they necessarily want to.
I have some friends that the lecturers have missed classes, so they're paying their fees and they're not exactly cheap.
Honestly, I think it's the cost of living. I feel like it's gone up substantially in the last years. Like, I remember when I was a first year in Roots, so I'm a third year now, it was 108 for accommodation. Now it's 120 something.
The prices on campus, there should be more inclusive to students.
I would say repression of Palestinian advocacy on campus. Definitely. I think the militarization of our campus and the university's refusal to listen to the students' voice.
A bit more events, maybe, yeah, a bit more fun to be here, more events to enjoy.
Cost of it is sometimes hard to actually keep up with. And then obviously you want to go out and stuff, but there's sometimes hard to get some lessons. And accommodation is expensive.
So those were some of the issues that students were really thinking about when they came to vote in the SU election. Speaking to Amelia Coleman there. Now turning to my studio panel here, what do we think about the elections week, the plenty of campaigning that happened on campus, and plenty of campaigning that took place online as well on social media. So what do we make of election week? Ben, this is your first SU elections. Yes. Here at Warwick. What did you make of it?
It was really fun. It was a nice week. I have to say the free drinking curiosity really heightened my love for elections. But as a politics student as well, you know, it's always an entertaining week just getting to see like how sort of campaigning works here at Warwick. You know, getting to see everyone make their Instagram accounts and promote them heavily, and then all the different banners and posters that were put up everywhere, the shirts all the democracy assistants were wearing. It was just a really nice experience. It gave it quite a community feel, I felt, just because, you know, everybody was sort of banded together on this one sort of, you know, issue throughout the week that, you know, so many different people were campaigning for. So it was just really entertaining, and it was a lovely week, I think, as well. Obviously getting to be part of the big decision as well on the Friday was also really entertaining. But yeah, it was just a really nice week, and I can't wait till next year.
Wow, some positive reviews. Matthew, I want to come to you next, because again, as a first year, this is your first experience of SU spring elections. You were nodding along to what Ben was saying. What did you think of the elections?
Yeah, again, like what Ben said, it was a really fun week. I suppose you could kind of tell when we were getting into election season because of the cardboard signs beginning to pop up with the names of the different candidates from everywhere, from the library to just outside the Oculus. That was really interesting, and all the posters being up. Now, I didn't get the opportunity to redeem my curiosity token, but I did vote, and it was really exciting to see who the candidates were and learn more about them, read the manifestos, and cast our votes, and then I was there at Big Decision, and that was just a great experience as well. So yeah, it was a very fun election season. I'm very happy to have been there.
Very good. Now, Angel and Glay, obviously, being third years as well as myself, we've seen a few of these SU spring elections. The curiosity free drink is something that was new this year, and I think it's safe to say that this might have had an impact on the turnout. Last year, we were looking around 4,000, I think it's 4,100 students voted. This year, we're over 5,500. So that's a pretty decent increase in the number of students that were voting in SU elections. Glade, do you think that the Curiosity free drink had an impact on that?
I also feel like, yeah, there was an incentive, but also the campaigns of both candidates were very, like, especially for the president SU-elect, were very enthralling. So it gave, one, Curiosity did give an incentive for people to vote, and two, also the campaigns of the candidates, like, gave another reason for people to vote. Because they don't, like, at least people weren't abstaining. Like, a lot of people, like, in my year actually had opinions. You'd be thinking, like, oh, third years, like, it's our last year. We have more pressing matters to be dealing with in our academics. But no, a lot of people were very heavily involved in, like, campaigning, trying to fully understand the manifestos and actually having conversations about it. And that's, I think that's what the most important thing is, that it's not only the incentive, but it's also that people actually care more about SU politics now. And I think it's such a positive thing.
Yeah, because one of the things the candidates for the president position who were really out campaigning, Molly Palmer and Anana Hall, both talking about the transparency of the SU. It was also something that came up in the candidate question time that took place a week before. Marie Vengerov was also asked about this, and all the candidates saying that they want students to understand what the SU is doing. We've seen the issue of all student votes, what happens to those when students vote on them, who do they go to, what processes do they go to. So I can agree, in being out following the campaigns during the week, you can see that candidates were having conversations with various different students that were walking by, whether that be the Piazza, Fab, anywhere else on campus. Now, Angel, what did you make of the elections? I know you've been having a little look at the turnout as well. And overall engagement. So what did you think of these SU elections?
I would say definitely it's good to see that the turnout increased, but I'm a bit critical. First of all, the turnout is still very low. And secondly, I'm not sure if the students are genuinely interested in the election, if they just vote because of the incentive. Because in the evening when the result was announced, I got into Curiosity because they put out a lot of free food and I saw my friend. So I got into Curiosity and I saw that a lot of people just grab the free food and then they go. They're not interested in the election at all. Also, whenever there is election, I just see the power of echo chamber in this world, because I know that a lot of people are very interested in the election. But on the other hand, one of my flatmates, I think she doesn't mind because she will not listen to this show anyway. She never cared about any politics or anything on campus. And also her friend also. Her friend never cared about this thing. And then she didn't even know who are the candidates and what are the role being voted. So I just think that, of course, there is incentive and the turnout increase. There's still a great amount of students who don't care about the election at all. And I'm not sure if people just vote because of the incentive. Do they really look at the manifesto and do they really understand what's going on?
Matthew, can I bring you in on this one?
Yeah.
Obviously, we've got the Curiosity free drink being an incentive. Do you think that had an impact?
It definitely did, but I understand Angel's point, because I have a friend who said to me that he was going to vote to get the Curiosity voucher, but then he would abstain on all the votes. So he would just kind of like just go through it just so he could get the drink. So yeah, it definitely had an impact on turnout. I imagine with a lot of people, they probably would do it like genuinely and actually try, but there's a couple of people I imagine took advantage of it, but just couldn't really be bothered or didn't have the time to read all the manifestos properly. So yeah, I reckon a lot of people might have there was an option to abstain, wasn't there?
There's also the option to reopen nominations as well, which is obviously, those are two legitimate ways that people can express their opinion through these elections. Obviously, people saying that the incentive of the free drink there may be swaying or impacting how they vote. But in terms of sort of being able to go through lots of the different manifestos, another thing that was different about these SU spring elections compared to the ones that we've experienced as third years is the election of the NUS conference delegates. Obviously, with the different all student vote motions to disaffiliate and then to reaffiliate or to stop the disaffiliation, it got to the point where these the delegates who were going to be going to the NUS conference in April needed to be voted on. And this was the time. So obviously with this being 8 positions up for grabs, obviously plenty of manifestos and plenty of candidates to go through on that one. What do we think that the NUS delegate selections brought to the campaign? Did it really add much?
I'm going to say this as someone who like personally interacted with them, because during Big D, I was kind of known as like the quote unquote decompressor. So they'd go to like after hearing results, people would go to ML2, and it'd be quite nice because then they could like relax, hear the results. I did chat to a few of the NUS delegates because they were happy to hear the results, but I personally didn't know what their agenda was. Like the one guy who I think, from what I remember, was like completely in it and campaigned was James Martin. And he was very much like, I will stick to my manifesto, like I'm really excited to be part of this role. The others were kind of like, not apathetic, but they, like, you know, at least, like, you know, some of them did show face, but it was just a question of what else can they bring for other students on this campus? Like, will we really be heard? So personally, like from having personal experience like with them, I'm not actually sure if they will add something, but I do like and appreciate James's enthusiasm behind this role.
Yeah, I mean, that is one thing that obviously in addition to the other part-time officer and full-time officer roles that are elected, lots of the candidates talking at the question time event about how they can let students know what happens at the NUS conference, and plenty of them had ideas on that, and I encourage you to read the manifestos and see what they said at the candidate question time for more information about that. But the NUS delegates going to the conference in Blackpool alongside Anna Taylor as SU president are James Martin, Rog Hacker, James Varney, Otto Aldridge, Grace Lewis, Mads Wayman, Isra Wright and Sophie Clark. And your part-time officers that were elected: Disabled Students Officer Mads Wayman and Nye Steele, Environment and Ethics Officer Rog Hacker, Ethnic Minorities Officer Sonjina Kao, LGBTQA Plus Officers Summer and Amber, Trans Students Officers Dorian Valentine and Isra Rai, Widening Participation Officer Matthew Stevenson and Hazen Wood, and Women's Officer Gassima Kerr. Those are the elected officers from these spring elections. And just to wrap up this section, I want to thank the SU Democracy team very much for their help and support in our coverage of everything to do with the SU elections, and for the honour of doing the big decision as well, which is all very, very exciting for us to get involved with. Right, well, coming up in a moment, we are going to be discussing the budget and what a week it has been for the Conservative Party.
Across campus, online and on 12:51 AM, this is your student radio station.
Introducing the Warwick History Hour, a brand new show in collaboration with the University of Warwick History Department.
Each week, we will interview a member of the History Department on their niche interest.
And hello and welcome to the Warwick History Hour. My name's Izzy Bailey and this is my brand new show.
But the thing that kind of struck me is that the law and the way the law is practiced is inherently performative.
There's stories that are told about how particular Peruvian dishes map out the country.
And my professors go, is it the one who studied potatoes? And this year, I was finally able to say yes. Yes, it is.
Tune in each week or listen back on Spotify.
Online.
On 12:51 AM.
Your student radio station.
Proving student radio can be good sometimes. Raw 12:51 AM.
We're about to discuss the budget here on Insight. Ben, Glay, Matthew and Angel are still here joining me in the studio. And we're going to have a little look at some of the things that were announced by Jeremy Hunt last week. Now, in his budget to do with tax, he announced that national insurance contributions for employees were being cut from 10% to 8% in April. Now, this will impact around 27 million workers with savings of up to £450 a year. Now, this is also reciprocated for the self-employed. Their national insurance rates will drop by 2 percentage points as well. Another thing to do with tax is the non-dom tax status has been abolished. So foreign nationals who live in the UK but are officially domiciled overseas, they'll no longer be able to avoid paying UK tax on their overseas income or capital gains. Obviously a policy which the Labour Party had previously been discussing but has come up in this budget. To do with benefits, the high income benefit charge which hits payments if one parent earns above £50,000 a year, is set to move to a household-based system, so there'll be a rise in the threshold in there. The Household Support Fund is extended for a further 6 months as well. There'll also be a new British ISA allowing £5,000 annual investment into UK businesses, which includes all the tax advantages of other ISAs and will be on top of existing allowances. There'll be a duty introduced on vaping liquids for the first time in October 2026, and a one-off increase in tobacco duty will be made as well. Alcohol duty has been frozen, or the freeze is extended until February 2025. There'll be no change to fuel duty as well at this point. And in terms of business support, VAT registration thresholds for businesses has been upped from £85,000 to £90,000. And there are also some incentives for film studios in England, where they can secure 40% relief on their gross business rates until 2034. Now, to bring this all together, the Office for Budget Responsibility has predicted that UK GDP growth will be around 0.8% in 2024 and 1.9% in 2025. Now, these are slightly above what the OBR had predicted last November. Now, obviously, we're going into a general election sometime soon. You may have heard about that on Insight. We've mentioned it a few times.
Just a couple.
Do you think that this is a budget that the Conservatives are going to want to fight the next general election on?
I do. I think it is. I mean, when I look at it, the general consensus that I saw from people I know looking at the budget was that it didn't really go far enough, and it still felt quite far behind of what people wanted from a budget. But I can see both sides in it, because I can understand why, you know, in the sort of post-pandemic, post-mini budget era, the Conservatives would want to be more cautious in, you know, what they add onto their budget and that sort of stuff. But then I can also understand, you know, obviously there are clear, you know, struggles within the working class, where people, you know, are struggling to get by and need support from the government to do so. So I can really see both sides in that aspect. But I do think that this budget in particular is somewhat worrying for Labour, because I think specifically the abolition of non-dom tax status, you know, that's something that Labour was basing a lot of their budget off of in regards to how they would fund their plans when in government. And so now the fact that the Conservative government is getting this underway, it puts pressure on Labour to try and find alternative sources of revenue for what they'd already proposed. So yeah, I'd say if anything, this budget puts a fair bit of pressure on Labour and Rachel Reeves specifically to see how she'll fund her plans when she possibly comes into government later this year. But yeah, I think it's a controversial budget, but I think it's one where I can see both sides of the argument.
Yeah, because the non-dom tax status, as you were saying, Ben, was a key issue which Rachel Reeves, as Shadow Chancellor, was trying to create kind of a clear division with the Conservative Party on. We'll come back to a little bit more about public services in a second, but just on this non-dom tax status, what do my other panellists think about that? Effectively, taking a policy that was first put forward by the Labour Party.
I'm just going to kind of link that to the budget as a whole, but I will focus on the tax status. I'll say this: it's not going to save them. I think that ship has left the port like about 2 years ago with a mini budget. So, yeah, you know, like what Ben said though, it could potentially put a bit of pressure on Labour, because I think the biggest question going into this next election is not if the Conservatives can win, because they certainly can't, but in my opinion at least, but you know, it's like, how narrow is it gonna be? Like, what's the margin gonna be? So it you know, if the Conservatives come out, I mean, this is definitely not the worst budget they've done, and it, you know, I understand again what Ben says, that, you know, in some ways it's very much a very moderate bill, like moderate budget, you know, being very delicate. I don't think we're seeing like massive tax cuts or anything. Like, you know, usually with a general election you expect somewhat, you know, significant tax cuts, we're not getting that because as what happened when Hunt first became Chancellor, you know, he said he made it clear that now's probably not the time for tax cuts. So yeah, it's definitely an interesting budget, definitely got some interesting things in there, and with the non-dom tax status, that is actually a really interesting detail that they've done. You know, definitely probably take, you know, added in there as part of their competition with Labour. So as a, yeah, as we said, you know, I don't think it will save them, but I do think that it could put pressure on Labour to start marketing their, you know, coming up to the election, marketing what their positions are a bit more, like what makes their positions, you know, unique. Like, why should we vote for them? Yeah,
and obviously the discussion around tax cuts versus public spending is often these two things kind of brought into comparison. Yeah. And just to go on to some of the promises that were made about the NHS and public spending. So the NHS is to get around £2.5 billion this year to tackle issues, including waiting lists. Obviously, this is something that we've seen coming out of the pandemic and the backlog in cases. And planned growth in day-to-day public sector spending is going to be maintained at 1% in real terms. But the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, saying that we are going to spend it better. Now, this could entail the NHS productivity plan, which was introduced by the government fairly recently, to work out where money can best go in the NHS. Just on this healthcare spending, wonder if I can bring you in, Angel, on this. What have you made of this and the fact that, this money, £2.5 billion, is going to the NHS. Do you think that's going to be enough public sector spending? Do you think that's going to be something that the general public support?
I think the public will support, but I'm not sure if the increase in funding will really help in accelerate the public health service or shorten the waiting list, because I think that the major problem is not just about the lack of funding but how the money is used. For example, they get more funding for the dental service, but it's about how the resources are allocated to different dental clinics. Also, I think that the reason why the backlog is so huge is that the administrative system is so ineffective and outdated, so they can't really deal with the waiting list in a very efficient way. So I think that the government really need to think about how to update the administrative system and how they organize these long waiting lists.
Now, Glay, if I can bring you in on this one. Public sector spending, particularly in healthcare, is something that we've discussed on the show before. Do you think that the government should be putting more into public services? Is that going to be a vote winner, especially if this general election comes closer towards autumn and winter, when we continue to talk about pressures on the NHS?
I personally think it's a make or break for a lot of people, and especially with a lot of the immigrants who come here and work for the wonderful NHS. It's just a shame that obviously, you know, it's come down to this. And yes, like Adrian was correct in saying that a system that was built for only millions of people cannot sustain, like, almost, you know, like the exponential growth of people hasn't been able to match up for the healthcare system. So I think the case is, like, will either party be willing to, like, you know, spend enough, promise that they'll cut down the waiting list, and will they stick to those promises? Because that will definitely impact who votes for them and how they're going to vote. Because again, with dental care and healthcare, people have been seeking treatment in other countries because they can't do, or going privately because they can't do, like, look at the royal family, like Kate's recently come out of operation from the London Clinic, which is a private practice. So again, if you've got the money, you can go privately, but at the end of the day, you know, for the average working person, the healthcare matters so much, and a lot of people take pride in healthcare, especially with being British. So this definitely will make or break a lot of people's decisions in an upcoming general election.
And obviously, we wait to see when this general election is going to be. But one thing that is not helping the Conservatives at the moment is some of their poll ratings. A poll by Ipsos for the Evening Standard last week saw that the Conservatives had their lowest poll rating for around 40 years, putting them on about 20 points, or on 20 points, I should say. They're around 27 back in January, and this is obviously a significant fall behind the Labour Party at the moment. So with these poor poll ratings, plus the defection of former deputy chairman of the party, Lee Anderson, to Reform. Obviously, he had the whip suspended over his comments that he made about Sadiq Khan and about London. See, he's now moved on to Reform, and there's always going to be speculation when this happens about whether more MPs will follow in his footsteps and join the Reform. Where do we think the Conservative Party sit currently with these poll ratings, but also MPs defecting to Reform, or just one at the moment, but potential for more?
I think the issue with the Conservatives now is their biggest enemy is not Labour, it's themselves. They are literally tearing themselves apart, and to be honest, they kind of have been ever since, for as long as I can remember now. I think I've said a couple of weeks ago on Insight, and I've said it a few times, I think probably the biggest issue for the Conservatives is a lot of people are probably looking more towards Reform who would otherwise vote for Conservatives, and that could potentially split the vote between those two. So we could see the Conservative Party shrink quite a lot. I'm not sure. We could see more defections. I don't know, because I think probably what a lot of people, a lot of MPs probably think is because it's technically a two-party duopoly. You know, it's like if you're not in the Conservative Party, you've got less chance of being in government. So, you know, I'm hesitant to say we'll see many defections, but yeah, the fact that Lee Anderson's defected is somewhat significant, but it is only one seat. I'm more interested in the fact that they're polling at about, 12% last time I checked, and I think they're now beating out the Liberal Democrats, and it's like, you know, we could see them getting a few seats. So, but I think the main takeaway is that it will just shrink, depend on how broad it is, because that's what usually happens. Sometimes it's a broad spread and it doesn't manifest in seats. But yeah, we could see it's definitely going to be a hindrance to the Conservative Party. And I think what they really got to do is kind of figure out now what direction do we want the party to go in, because it's clear that the Conservative Party of the past is kind of like fighting with, you know, people wanted to take it in a different direction. So yeah, I think it's kind of like somewhat with the elements of what's going on with the Republicans in America, but maybe a bit more over here. Yeah, they just got to figure out what direction they want to go in, I think.
So that latest poll from Ipsos having Labour on 47%, the Conservatives on 20%, Liberal Democrats on 9%, Greens on 8%, Reform on 8%, and other listed as 7%. Now, do we think that this defection of Lee Anderson to Reform UK is actually going to have any impact whatsoever come the general election? Is this just a stunt because he's been kicked out of the Conservative Party, or is this going to be a trend?
I mean, I think personally, you can predict that the splintering of the Conservative Party was only going to get worse and worse, especially with, the kind of, was it, the five factions with the One Nation? Is it One Nation?
You got, was it the five yeah. families
the five
and then
families,
versus
yeah.
the One Nation? When we were discussing nation, all of those yeah. different debates around yeah. human rights, the Rwanda bill. Yeah.
So you can even see with these set up the factions within the Conservative Party that it was going to inherently splinter, and then now you've gotten individuals who are considered massive figures making this election more interesting. And I think that possibly, you know, with a lack of confidence in other members, within their leadership, and with other members of the main members of the Conservative Party, more people will be slowly leaving. And I think it'll more be like a behind the scenes kind of thing. More people will slowly be leaving behind the scenes, then it will be a build up to big names. But I don't think it'll be a drastic drop of 10 people. It'll be probably a gradual process.
Mm-hmm. Ben, can I get your view on this? State of the Conservative Party, obviously having this budget, poor poll ratings. Do you think that Rishi Sunak is going to stay on course for the general election to be in the second half of this year?
I mean, when I look at all the Lee Anderson stuff, that's obviously not helped Rishi Sunak in the past week. And then we've also had the stuff that was just sort of developed over the last 24 hours with one of the largest, if not the largest, conservative donor making remarks about Diane Abbott. And so I think all of this, you know, is a sort of culmination of what we've generally seen ever since COVID, really, and Partygate within the Conservative Party, and that is the sort of re-emerging idea of sleaze and that sort of stuff. And I think that that is very prevalent to voters, and that's the sort of image that no party can shake off, let alone a party that is still dealing with those issues and will be until the general election. Because I mean, we've most likely, there's just been another recall petition put out for another Conservative MP, and I feel like it'll just keep cascading slowly until the general election, which I predict will probably be in October, November time. Just because I don't think Sunak would leave it till the last minute, as he wants to leave himself some flexibility. But yeah, it's a difficult situation, but I think that it's very prevalent that Sunak just won't be able to get out of this one, because it is just such a large and systemic issue within the Conservative Party that it's too difficult, even if it is shaken off tomorrow, it's still too difficult to shake off that image in time for the general election.
You mentioned, Ben, the recall petition going on in Blackpool at the moment. Yes. Scott Benson, that opened, I believe, yesterday. And also the case of Frank Hester, one of the, as you said, one of the largest donors for the Conservative Party, accused of making racist remarks about Diane Abbott, the former Labour MP, currently sitting as an independent. Mr. Hester said he accepts that he was rude about Diane Abbott in a private meeting several years ago, but his criticism had nothing to do with her gender nor colour of her skin. Obviously, he said in this, he, seeing Diane Abbott on the TV, wanted her being on the TV made him want to hate all black women, and said that she should be shot. And obviously, Mr. Hester responding to these comments that were made in 2019. And I think we're going to come on a little bit to that a little bit later on in this podcast. But Angel, just to wrap us up with the discussion about the Conservatives, let's have a look at Labour, shall we? What do you think they should be doing? What do you think they should be doing in this position with the Conservatives? Obviously having these poor poll ratings, are they okay kind of in the position where they are, or should they be going more on the front foot and saying these are the policies that we want to be doing as a government?
Definitely. I think the Labour should take a more clear and stronger stance about their opinion on different controversial issues nowadays, such as the Middle East or just cost of living or whatever, because I feel like people don't like Conservative, so they go for Labour, but it is not a good reason for voting them, because it means that they're not genuinely supporting the Labour. Also, I think that the Reform UK also suggests an alternative to those who do not really like who do not really like the Tories, so that I think Labour should definitely be more clear and like stronger about their political attitude and stance on different things.
Matthew, final word on this one.
I partially sort of disagree, because I think on some issues, yes, Labour should definitely come out with a bit more clarity. I like your point about the reform, about how people could turn to reform, but I think a good strategy at the moment, just for the time being, this could change in a few months, is just to let the Conservatives tear themselves apart, because here's the thing. We saw it with the non-dom tax thing. If Labour says something, Tories are going to go, I'm going to have that. I think they're playing the cards safe until we get to a point where we get to the election season gets properly underway. I reckon if they announced a general election like today to be held in May, then I think they should go a bit more on the issues. But I think at the moment it's just wiser. It's not the best. It's not like the best thing we could do. And preferably they probably should be. But I think the best strategy for them at the moment is just because it seems to be working. Let the Conservatives tear themselves apart, and we'll get in. So, yeah, but I do think there are one or two issues that could definitely go a lot harder on, especially, as you say, the Middle East and such. They should definitely be a lot more vocal about that.
Well, obviously, we wait to see when that general election will be, and I'm sure we'll get all the details in manifestos. That's when the parties will be able to put forward their vision for the country. Well, we've got one more thing to discuss here on Insight. We're going to take a quick break, and after that, we're going to be following on from Raw's Women's Week and International Women's Day last week, and discussing women in politics and in Parliament.
You can only get a first at Warwick if you listen to Raw Daily. This is your student radio station.
Looking for part-time work on campus? Looking for something extra for your CV? Looking for a graduate role after uni? UniTaps. Find a job that works for you.
In week 10, Raw is celebrating Women's Week with specialist programming from all departments. Each show is featuring female artists and celebrating Women's Week in their own way. We'll be placing a spotlight on women in music, speech, arts, news, and sports. For more information, follow our socials or stay tuned on Raw 1251 AM.
So for our final point of discussion here on Insight this week, it has been Women's Week here at Raw, International Women's Day, taking place last week. So we thought it would be a good idea to take stock and have a look at our parliamentary system in the UK, at our political system, and see, is it inclusive? Is it welcoming for all, particularly for women? Now, as of February 2024, there are 225 women MPs in the House of Commons, which is the highest number ever. This is 35% of the number of MPs. And yeah, as I said, this is the all-time high that it's been at the moment. But often people, MPs themselves and people commentating, discuss how Westminster is such a male-dominated environment, whether that be in the House of Commons itself, in sort of the lobbying spaces around it, or in the media as well. So I wanted to see what my panel thought about this, the fact that obviously 35% is the split at the moment, and anything that they think should be done to make Parliament a less male-dominated environment.
I mean, you know, when you discuss like representation just on the whole, there's so many different forms it can take. I mean, you'd obviously, you know, initially want sort of Parliament to be a direct mirror of UK society, and obviously, you know, women in Parliament being at 35% is not comparative in the slightest. But then, you know, you look at, you know, whether or not women are properly and women's rights are properly represented in Parliament, and I feel like you also see an issue there as well. And so I think in all forms of representation, Parliament is generally lagging behind on, you know, not even just women necessarily, just minority viewpoints, how they're represented and showcased in Parliament. It's very straight white male dominated, and it has been for a long time, and that's always been the status quo. And I just think that, you know, both in terms of what's being said and proposed in Parliament, and both in terms of the actual makeup of Parliament, it needs to change to properly represent British society.
So how do you think that can be achieved? Is it a case of parties having particular, we see cases of all-female shortlists for MPs, for prospective parliamentarians when they're getting a seat? Would you want to see more of that?
I mean, I'd say so. I think that it can work. I do think that, you know, inherently in politics, it's always the thing of, you know, no matter what it is, the best candidate should get that spot. And, you know, whether or not it was a male or a female, you know, debating on that sense, it's just a case of merit. But I do think that women are severely underrepresented in Parliament in terms of their physical presence within Parliament. And so, obviously, to get in more female MPs to make a more accurate look, a more accurate representation of, you know, British society, I don't think that that would hurt at all. I mean, when you look at, you know, even like just increasing it slightly, because I think 35% really is at the level where it's just not at all, you know, to the standard at which it should be. But I think even just increasing it by a little bit will go a long way. Yeah.
Angel, do you want to come on this one?
Yeah, I think that also a lot can be done on maybe some personal level, because it just reminds me of the COVID inquiry when the former Deputy Cabinet Secretary Helen McNamara said that the COVID inquiry, like the during COVID, the Downing Street is definitely a toxic environment for women to work, because women are just given 10 to 15 minutes to express their opinion in any of their meetings and conference. So I feel like apart from this kind of percentage of women candidate, I feel like a lot can be done on a personal level on how MPs should interact with each other in a respectful way, or make sure that everyone is given a fair opportunity to express their opinions.
I mean, I was going to say as well, obviously Ben's brought this up very briefly, but the culture surrounding Parliament has kind of deterred people, and also even like the culture around like voting for women, like that, like I watched, I remember I was in year 12, there was a conference between Oliver Dowden, and it was just like the local MPs just trying to get, and the Labour MP completely forgot her name, and the Lib Dems, like they see, and that's where the problem stems, and it's just the way I think society has been set up, and it is targeted towards a certain demographic of people, not only just straight white men, but those who come from a certain class. And proportionally, I even think, like, when Ben was saying that it should reflect Britain, though the reason why people are minorities, it would actually reduce the number of minorities in Parliament, because there is still, like, there's still a majority of white British people, but then there are so many specific issues that because of the majority white British Parliament, they're not going to be able to comment on those issues or vote for those issues. So it's not a question of merit. They're not, you know, are they really qualified to be talking about it?
Obviously, one thing that we've been discussing is the all-women shortlists for MPs. It's been reported that the Labour Party have dropped using these because 52% of the party's MPs are women. And there are obviously legal implications with the Equality Act and so on about using these sort of lists. There's one other issue I wanted to touch on before we finish related to this issue, is the idea of maternity leave and the idea of the strains that being an MP puts on parliamentarians. Obviously, people expect when they vote parliamentarians in, when MPs are elected, that they're going to have this duty to fill. And there will be times where it is demanding. They're obviously having to go to lots of different votes and discussions. But there have been questions over whether the culture of this has put many people off becoming MPs, and so we don't have that representation of the country, as you might say. And one of the groups of people that are often discussed are mothers, and the fact that taking maternity leave, whether they can balance all these different things in being able to become an MP. Do you think this is a particular issue, and how can we sort of fix that and make Parliament a more inclusive place in that way?
I think that probably they can learn, the British Parliament can learn from other countries. For example, I remember that for New Zealand Parliament, some women MP can actually bring their babies to their workplace. And there are lots of childcare support to any MPs with children. So that I think it's not only about maternity leave, but also all sort of support to all the working mums working in the government or any other working mum in the civil servant. So yeah, and also just now we talk about the accessible support, such as the wheelchair path in the parliament, so that I think that the parliament should definitely be made a more inclusive space in terms of this kind of like hardware support.
Yeah, I agree. I think I'm not sure what the current situation is like, but maybe they could do with some sort of like childcare services within you know the parliament. Surely there's got to be like a room that they can convert into a proper, fully equipped facility where, you know, MPs can come to vote and they can leave their children in safe, secure hands. I think this is something that, you know, the government can definitely put funding towards, you know, to helping out to make sure that these members can get to their votes.
Obviously, proxy voting is one thing in this area. Angel, what you were saying about New Zealand, that's the Labour MP here in Britain, Stella Creasy. She'd brought her newborn baby into the House of Commons, and there was a whole report that was done, a committee, procedural committee, looking whether babies could be brought into the House of Commons with mothers who were making statements or asking questions. And the group ruled that MPs should not bring babies into the chamber or Westminster Hall, where they have lots of these debates. Well, they said that there should be some discretion involved in this. So obviously, various different questions around that as well. Well, MPs are, I can remember watching it at the time, or seeing clips, and fellow MPs describing newborn baby, describing him as good as gold during the debates, but the House of Commons committee saying that it was a long-standing practice underpinned by previous rulings that babies should not be present during debates and question time. So obviously that is a whole different area of discussion as well, which we probably haven't got time to go into today. But I think that's where we're going to end today. So I want to thank my panel very much for joining me which has been a very kind of different edition of Insight this week. And my final one as well, as head of news.
Thank you, James, for 3 terms of Insight.
Well, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed being in this role of head of news at Raw, being able to get out on campus, have conversations with people, have people like you in the studio who make my job so much easier every week, being able to discuss everything that's going on. And just as we finish, I want to thank you for listening as well. It's been great to have you along in this journey, whether you've been getting in touch with us on social media, here in the studio, or whether you've just been enjoying the show each week. And we really do appreciate your support, and I can't wait to see what Amelia's got in store for the news department next term. So I think what's left for me to say is I've been James Lewis. Thank you very much for listening to Insight.
You are the creator of Musician Nutrition.
Yeah, it's my idea.
Apologies for that small technical hitch there. I pressed the wrong button.
Sport.
This new football generation is so overconsumed by stats.
Probably why you've seen a bit of a decline in true number nine goal scorers.
£1 billion bottle jobs.
Arts. That's the Chris Nolan effect, though. Chris Nolan makes Oscar bait films that do well box office.
Sorry, guys, but if you give your partner a pair of shoes, they will run away from you.
Speech. You would never see me on public transport ever again, Uber everywhere. I mean, please, I'm sure some of you guys do that already.
It's because I speak actual English, that's why. Sorry for that.
News. The Parthenon is just like this really kind of integral part of Greece. Imagine if the Houses of Parliament were blown up by someone who invaded England.
And instead of looking into why does this child not feel safe in school, they went, you can't call your mum without asking us first.
Hello and welcome to The Big Decision 2024. I'm James Lewis, the head of news here at 12:51 AM. I'm one of your co-hosts for this evening.
Thank you to those still sticking with us. We are still covering the semi-finals here at Battle of the Bands. I'm here with Projectile Dysfunction, who just closed an amazing set.
Welcome back to Raw's coverage of Varsity 2024. We're back for the women's volleyball. But before that,
the bear's coming.
The bear's coming.
Do you think we can get?
Is the bear? Can we get is the bear? That wait?
Can we get away
call him
bear?
Over.
This is Raw 12:51 AM.